Department successfully argued then that only the federal government can require legal residents to carry proof of their immigration status, and that local law enforcement officers do not have the right to demand the status of people they stop. Ted Robbins, NPR News, San Francisco. Little G-G-O.
Pontiac's 84-year ride as one of the key brands of the American auto industry is over. The GM brand now officially extinct. Pontiac's popularity peaked in the 1960s. 1968, nearly a million Pontiacs were sold. Models such as the GTO and the Trans Am were two of Detroit's iconic muscle cars. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Nissan, with the 100% electric, no-gas Nissan Leaf. Innovation for the planet, innovation for all. Details at NissanUSA.com.
Wednesday night at 8 on WYLL-TV, take a ringside seat for the premiere of Circus. Get a behind-the-scenes look at life inside the Big Apple Circus, from the big top to the back lot. And meet the amazing performers and dedicated crew who deal with the excitement, triumphs, and failures of circus life every day. Because no matter what, the show must go on. Wednesday night at 8 on WYLL-TV.
Support for WYLL comes from WGLT in Bloomington Normal, hosting Radio Faces on Friday, November 5th, featuring dinner, cocktails, and conversation with NPR Science Desk correspondent Robert Krulwich. Tickets and information at WGLT.org.
From Illinois Public Radio, this is Focus on WILL Radio and online at will.illinois.edu. Good morning, I'm Celeste Quinn. The producer for Focus is Harriet Williamson. Our technical director this morning is Kyle Mabry. Visualizing Tibet is the theme of the 2010 Asian Film Festival at the Spurlock Museum at the University of Illinois and at the Art Theater in downtown Champaign. The festival opens tomorrow evening, November 2, 2010, at the Spurlock Museum in Urbana. Seven films will be screened there through Sunday. On Wednesday evening, Martin Scorsese's film Kundun will be screened at the Art Theater in downtown Champaign. Visualizing Tibet is free and open to the public. This morning, we'll talk about Tibet and visualizing Tibet with two guests. We'll also hear a short interview I did with one of the filmmakers of the documentary Summer Pasture. Lynn True and I spoke last Friday. She will be one of the special guests featured at the 2010 Asian Film Festival. Our guests this morning are Nancy Jervis and Elliot Sperling. Nancy Jervis is the program director for the Asian Educational Media Service at the U of I. Elliot Sperling is at Indiana University, where he teaches in the Tibetan Studies program. He, too, will be a special festival guest. You'll find a link to the festival website at our website, will.illinois.edu, or through the Asian Educational Media Service website. That website is www.aems.illinois.edu. The Asian Film Festival is presented by the Asian Educational Media Service, the Spurlock Museum, and the Illinois-Indiana East Asia National Resource Center Consortium. Listeners, I invite you to join us this morning with a phone call or by email. Here are the phone numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Our toll-free number is 800-222-9455, and the email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. 800-222-WILL, will-talk@illinois.edu. Good morning to our guest. Elliot Sperling is with us this morning on the telephone. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
And Nancy Jervis is here with me in the studio. Nancy, good morning.
Good morning to you.
Well, I thought one of the things we could talk about here at the beginning would be the subject of language. The films are in Chinese or Tibetan. And recently, there have been large protests in Western China against plans to eliminate or reduce the use of the Tibetan language in schools. Elliot Sperling, can you bring us up to date on that?
Well, these protests have been going on for some time, and they have not really been quelled in spite of pronouncements from some officials that these plans are going to be held in abeyance for the time being. But clearly, this is a very, very sensitive issue. These protests started in the Tibetan area that is called Amdo, and that is the site for some of the films that we're going to see. Indeed, The Search, it takes place in some of the areas that have been the scene of these protests. And essentially, what it involves is the authorities have basically decided that in the school system in these areas, classes that were previously taught in Tibetan are to be taught in Chinese, and ultimately only specific Tibetan language classes, classes dealing with the Tibetan language or Tibetan literature, only those will be allowed to continue in Tibetan. Now, this is a serious issue, and I think people who see some of these films may understand just how serious this is. The Tibetans have a long literate tradition. The Tibetan script, for instance, is the oldest continually used script, continually used for the same language in Inner Asia. Its adoption in Tibet is, it takes place about the same time that the Japanese adopt their writing system. And there is a huge corpus of Tibetan literature and a large literati. And the area in which these protests took place are areas that are part of that specific tradition. So what's going to happen if this goes through is that you will have a generational split. Up until the present generation, people read and write as part of the tradition going back to the last century, the century before that, and before that, a tradition of people from that area, of an intellectual tradition from that area. And if this is put into effect, and if Tibetan students will be educated in Chinese, it will be a tremendous rupture in the tradition. So you can imagine how emotional this is for people.
Yeah. Let me bring Nancy Jervis into the conversation here. Nancy, does China have an official policy in terms of language and other ethnic groups? Because we're talking about a great number of peoples.
Right. Well, one of their arguments with Tibetans, with Mongolians and Inner Mongolian and other ethnic groups is that in order to function in the bureaucracy and to rise up, they need to know Chinese. They also need to know English to get into the university system. So this makes it their own language, a third language. So the argument from the Chinese end has been, you know, that they have to keep it as a third language and not as a first language. But as Elliot says, that creates a lot of problems. So I think this is something that is happening throughout other minority nationality areas.
Now, forgive me for my ignorance, but is the official Chinese language Mandarin or Cantonese, or what is it?
It's Mandarin, and it's been Mandarin both in Taiwan. This is something that neither Taiwan nor China disagreed on, except, of course, there have been local attempts both by Cantonese speakers, Shanghainese speakers, and by local Taiwanese speakers to have that their spoken language heard on the radio and in television and so forth, and the Chinese government. So if you go anywhere in China and you speak Mandarin, you will be understood because they on the other hand, you, as a Mandarin speaker, might not be able to understand what they say back to you because they will probably speak in their own local dialects.
Yeah, there's another issue which I might bring up, which also relates to the content of some of the films, which is effectively it's the question, what does it mean to be modern? And the Chinese state is essentially telling Tibetans that being modern means using Chinese and not using this, best, quaint local language.
Mm-hmm. Well, we just mentioned, Elliot Sperling, you mentioned a couple of moments ago the film The Search. And this involves a film crew going out into Tibet in this region, Amdo, and trying to find people to play the roles of a very important touchstone of Tibetan theater. But in the film, The Search, it is difficult to find people who know the story.
Actually, it's difficult to find the good actor. Everybody knows about the play. I mean, there's a canon of Tibetan theater, and people know about them. They might not know the specific stories, but it has a good deal of prestige. And so they're trying to find somebody to play the roles, at a certain level. But it really does present the whole artistic milieu, and it's a fascinating film because you see they're going through these terrains, you know, in the northeastern portion of the Tibetan Plateau, in this area called Amdo, and it really ties that into the fact that what looks very much like just a rural area, you don't know much about any cultural production in that area, is actually very, very rich.
And I do want to go back, though, to the idea of one. I haven't seen the entire film, The Search, but I started watching it, and it seemed to me that this is a play, a story that is a classic in Tibet, but it's no longer performed. Maybe that's where I got my idea of that.
Yeah, no. It is performed, and people have memories of certain special performances, but, yeah, part of the story, indeed, has to do with this clash with modernity and the dogged determinism of this. I don't want to get anybody into any political trouble, but the dogged determinism of this crew, you know, to put on, a fantastic to film a fantastic performance of this classical Tibetan play. There is nothing which is overtly, pro-Tibetan. Except that the film, in many ways, in very subtle ways, is a celebration of Tibetan culture and of its place in the modern world. But yes, you're absolutely right. There are difficulties encountered. The world has changed, and there are certain elements, of course, which are not really elucidated. But any Tibetan watching them would know. The destruction of Tibetan culture, the attempted destruction of Tibetan culture. During the Cultural Revolution, and even in periods before the Cultural Revolution. I mean, this is all there. The other part of it, with regard to the language question, is when you're listening to it, of course, they're speaking in Amdo dialect, and in a way that is somewhat similar to what you find with Chinese, the Tibetan writing system, which is an alphabet. It doesn't use character scripts, but the writing system, because it has certain classical forms, is such that people speaking different dialects, even if their syntax and even if their vocabulary might be somewhat different, generally, if they're educated, will understand what is written, and they will understand the text of these plays. But when they perform them, you hear them pronouncing things using this Amdo dialect, which is very much different from what is taught as standard Tibetan in almost all institutions that teach Tibetan, which is the dialect of Lhasa.
Has this film been seen widely in Tibet?
In Tibet, I don't know, but I would want to just add one thing. It did win an award in China. It won a film award, and also it's co-produced by Tian Zhuangzhuang, who is a very prominent filmmaker of the fifth generation in China. So it obviously had some support I think. One of the interesting things about Chinese censors when it comes to film is that if it's not in the dialogue, it doesn't necessarily get censored. So when you go around Tibet, as this filmmaker does, and when the scenes and the scenery doesn't usually get censored because the film censors are only looking at the scripts, and there's nothing to worry about with the script. So these things, often you see films that are critical when in some way make you think when you see them, maybe not when you just read them.
Yeah, I should also say with regard to things like Tibetan films, in the People's Republic of China, one has to avoid the political issue of Tibet. Chinese try and avoid the political issue of Tibet, but at the same time, they're part of international and global trends as well. And this fascination with Tibet as an exotic place is very much there. So there is a lot of interest in things Tibetan on the part of ordinary Chinese. And indeed, you'll find within Tibet Chinese backpackers traveling around. Now, of course, it doesn't have the same political content, a trip to Tibet, as it might have for somebody who is not Chinese. But that exoticism is there even for Chinese. And so these films have a certain resonance and popularity within China on their own.
I would also add to that that it's in terms of any independent film, which this is, it's very hard for the, there's no real distribution outlet for those films, and they basically travel around on DVDs, you know, that are copied and that are sold maybe for a few dollars. If they're seen, it's by word of mouth that they circulate.
It's not necessarily in a theater,
then. No, it's not. Usually not.
The film was made with, as Nancy Jervis mentioned, with production support from this well-known Chinese filmmaker. Are there many collaborations between Chinese and Tibetan artists?
In terms of film, I think that the Tibetan feature filmmaking operation is fairly recent. And a lot of it, by the way, it happens because of the same reason you have a lot of independent Chinese filmmaking. You have easy DVD production. So basically you have small cameras. You don't need a huge crew. And this crew that travels is just a couple of people. So it's easy to make movies now. And this film also is made from Tibetan story. There are basic Tibetan writers that are writing stories, then filmmakers making films out of them. And so in that way, it becomes a lot easier.
Yeah. Elliot Sperling, what's the distribution situation in Tibet? How do people see their films?
Well, I was going to say that most people probably see them on DVD,
mm-hmm.
and not necessarily the official DVD either. And various showings, but you know this is not unique to Tibet. You'll find the same thing in a lot of places in India, in Nepal. The DVD has changed the way these things are handled and the way they're distributed. It's also changed the economics. I really can't speak to that, but of course you do have a lot of people just simply copying DVDs, and that goes not just for Tibetan films or Chinese films, but for Western films as well, all over the world.
Hmm. In an interview in 2009 with National Public Radio, the filmmaker who made The Surge, Pema Seddon, I think I'm saying that correctly, said that for too long, Tibet was portrayed by outsiders, adding to the myth of Tibet and making it remote. Would you agree?
Well, there's a long tradition. I shouldn't say too long. It's not hundreds of years. But, since filmmaking began, there's a long tradition of the portrayal of the East or the Orient, however you want to call it. I mean, you can go back to something like The Thief of Baghdad, D.W. Griffith's Broken Blossoms. But in terms of portrayal of Tibet for the West, the touchstone is probably Lost Horizon. And from that, you get all sorts of exoticizations of Tibet that go into not just Western films, but even Chinese films. I have a few Chinese films which really portray that exoticism as well. They're from Hong Kong. But it's the same sort of thing that I was talking about before, where you have, even for Chinese, you know, a veil of exoticism which is cast over Tibet. But indeed, I think, what Pema Seddon was really saying is that you don't have a portrayal of Tibet as Tibet in the sense that you can have a much more realistic portrayal of conditions in China. In other words, in the film, the Tibetans are, they are imagined Tibetans first and foremost, and then people second. And this is the sort of thing which you don't have in these films. And to a large extent, it's because Tibetans are now making films. And I should say, it's not only in Tibet and not only in the People's Republic of China, but you have a couple of exile filmmakers as well, or people who are in the Tibetan cultural world outside the PRC. Tenzin Sonam, of course, with Riju Saran, and others.
What do we learn about Tibet from what we see on the screen? Nancy mentioned a moment or two ago that the censors are interested in the script, the dialogue, So what do we learn about Tibet from what we see in this film on the screen?
Well, you know, if you watch something like The Search, I mean, they're just marvelous little things that are familiar to you, but which you don't see in generally staged portrayals of Tibetans. You know, just the little touches of daily life, the little ordinary things, the roads, the homes, what's inside the house, and the way in which people act. I mean, it's very, very different. Now, you know, the film festival starts off, of course, with Martin Scorsese's Kundun, which is a Hollywood movie. But it's a good movie, I have to say. I really like it, but it doesn't give you that same view of Tibet. Of course, the movies, many of the movies that are in the festival, deal with present-day Tibet. And so you see daily life, and something like Kundun is an historical movie, and like all historical movies, it's going to present things in grand strokes. The genius of Scorsese, if I may put it this way, is he basically accepts that some of what he's going to show in narrative comes in the form of dream and vision. By no means, you know, all of the movie, but yet he uses that, and he creates a much more realistic portrait of Tibet's history and of the actors in Tibet's history than, say, the movie 7 Years in Tibet, which eschewed any use of vision and dream, and yet was a far, far more unrealistic portrayal of Tibet than what you get with Scorsese. Now, in these other films that we're seeing, of course, you really get the day-to-day life, the sort of things that an historical epic will really not dwell on, and that's really fascinating. And when Tibetans watch these things, especially Tibetans who are in exile or haven't been back to Tibet for a decade, 2 decades or whatever, I mean, just they're just fascinated, they're just riveted by watching how things have changed. It's quite an experience watching it with them.
Yeah, for me, I'm not a specialist in Tibet, and I have heard, you know, all of the exoticized and the politicized elements of Tibet for years, and what I get out of watching the films, especially taken all together, is a sense of this incredible civilization that's really unified in a lot of ways, that's very a fabric almost that I wasn't aware of, and that, as you can see in all of the films, about half of the films are set in contemporary Tibet, and in all of those films, you see modernization, or whatever you want to call it, lurking around the corners of the mountains, and you also see the gorgeous mountains, but you really see a civilization that we don't have in a lot of ways. And I got really in more of an understanding of the draw of Tibet, and what is at risk in our, and I don't think there's anything that can stop quote unquote modernization or globalization or however you want to call it, but it's worth seeing at every stage that you can this incredible civilization, and that's what I get.
I think part of one of the obstacles for people coming from the outside who are not too familiar with it when they watch something like this is that they have perhaps subconsciously assimilated certain Chinese categories. And so the Tibetans, like a lot of other people, have been assimilated as China has constructed its own identity in the 20th century. These people have been assimilated as quote-unquote national minorities. And under that heading of or minority nationality, excuse me, although now people in China seem to have understood that nationality has certain implications that the state doesn't like, and they're trying to replace that in translation with the term ethnicity. But in any event, they've generally been termed minority nationalities, and under that heading, you have groups, some of them have maybe a few tens of thousands of people with no literate historical tradition of their own, and certainly not like people like the Mongols and the Tibetans, state bureaucracies that functioned in the language of the nationality itself for centuries. And so you have all these different people grouped together, and many people tend to think, oh, yes, minority nationality. They associate the word primitive, somehow undeveloped, and all of these things with them, and the fact is that you have such a wide range of peoples who have been swept up under this term in the construction of the Chinese state that people tend to forget that there really is a civilization, a literate bureaucratic civilization. The Tibetans, after all, had a central government that posted officials all the way into the west on the Indian border. I mean, they really had a functioning government under the Dalai Lamas. And sometimes this sort of thing is equated in people's minds with groups that, as I said, numbered maybe 20, 30, 40,000 and lived in little villages and didn't have a writing system, whereas the Tibetans have, they have written their own history. One forgets that during the period of China's Tang Dynasty, the Tibetans were one of the most powerful countries on the face of the earth. They occupied very briefly, admittedly, but nevertheless they occupied the Chinese capital and remained a threat to China for most of that period. All of this is recorded in the official Tang history. So they encounter something, if they're just approaching it from the standpoint of, you know, yes, this is just a minority nationality, a small ethnic group, they may encounter something that they weren't expecting when they see these films.
Mm. This is Focus. Visualizing Tibet is the theme of the 2010 Asian Film Festival at the Spurlock Museum at the University of Illinois and at the Art Theater in downtown Champaign. It opens tomorrow evening, November 2nd, at the Spurlock Museum in Urbana. Seven films will be screened there through Sunday. And then on Thursday evening, it's Kundun at the Art Theater in downtown Champaign. My apologies, in my introduction, I made an error there. Visualizing Tibet is free and open to the public. Our guests this morning are Elliot Sperling and Nancy Jervis. Nancy Jervis is the program director for the Asian Educational Media Service at the U of I. Elliot Sperling is at Indiana University, where he teaches in the Tibetan Studies program. He will be a special festival guest. And in just a moment, we'll play a little bit of an interview that I conducted last week with one of the filmmakers of the documentary Summer Pasture. Lynn True and I spoke on Friday. Listeners, you can join us this morning with questions, comments, 333-9455. That's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Toll-free 800-222-9455. Or you may join us by email. The email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. 333-9455, 800-222-9455, and will-talk@illinois.edu. However, I think right now it might be a good time to bring in to the program this morning the interview that I did with Lynn True about Summer Passage. We've talked a little bit this morning about daily life and about old and new, and I think we see this come across beautifully in this film, Summer Pasture. The film was shot in 2007. This is a film made by Lynn True, Nelson Walker, and Sering Perlo. Summer Pasture was shot in 2007 and completed 2.5 years later. The documentary follows a young nomadic herding family in eastern Tibet as they work over the summer, providing for themselves and their herd of yaks. Interestingly enough, their language was an issue in how long it took to complete this film. The husband and wife are Locho and Yama, and they have a young daughter. And the filmmakers are essentially invisible. There is no voiceover. Summer Pasture is deeply centered in the lives of Yama and Locho. They tell their stories and speak about the pressures on nomadic herders due to modernization and a desire for their children to have a better life than they have had. So last Friday, I spoke briefly by telephone with filmmaker Lynn True. Summer Pasture opens with scenes of what I would call a rodeo. It's very much a mix of old and new. What do you recall most vividly about that event?
That's actually a really good description of that opening scene, it sort of seeming like a rodeo. The way we kind of experienced it, or, you know, our first impressions were that it did feel kind of like a county fair. My family is actually from Cheyenne, Wyoming, my father's side, so I'd actually been to a number of rodeos growing up, and that's really what it does feel like. But even more so than I think the typical or some of the rodeos I had been to in in the States, this one had a much more chaotic feel. There are so many different games and contests and kind of performances going on all the time. And I think the audience is, you know, this is something that happens on an annual basis, but everyone really looks forward to it. So really all the, you know, community members come out from the town, and it's a really, you know, kind of special event.
The family, wife Yama and husband Locho and their baby daughter, who are at the heart of this film, are nomadic herders. Would you tell us a little bit about the daily routine of their lives in summer?
Sure. Well, summer is their most busy and productive season. You know, they are at kind of the season of the year that has sort of the nicest weather. You know, it's the warmest, even though that doesn't mean it's particularly balmy all the time. As you see in the film, it's raining and snowing and sleeting, you know, fairly consistently. But the weather does permit them to produce the most out of their yaks, which are their primary means of survival. So the yaks are at their most productive. You know, the milk is the richest, so they're saving up butter and cheese and all these dairy products that they'll use throughout the fall and winter months. So this basically means that Yama, who is the female member of the family and pretty much the main producer, she will rise every day around 3:30 in the morning and start her daily chores. And so that includes milking the yaks, collecting fresh yak dung, which she will spread out into kind of these thin globes on the ground and let it dry in the sun, when she'll eventually rake it up and they'll use that to light their fire. She's taking care of the baby. She's making the meals. She's spinning and weaving yak hair for the fabric they use for their tent and other items. So her day starts at 3:30 and it ends usually around 9 or 10 o'clock at night. And most of the time, Locho, the husband, is tending to the yaks, herding, taking them to fresh grass areas, and basically watching over them.
Their lives are so different from my life, yet I am so drawn to them because of things we share, our ups and downs, laughter and heartbreak. How do audiences respond to the film?
Very much so like you just described. I think people have really related to this family as, in many ways, a very typical family, like, you know, our own families or families that we know right next door. They're a young couple. In the film, Locho is 30 and Yama's 27 years old, and their baby is 5.5 months. And so like many couples, they struggle with, you know, getting the baby to bed and feeding her and comforting her while also carrying on very busy work lives during the day. So I think a lot of the reaction from audiences we found is just as you described. They really feel like they can relate to the trials and tribulations of being a couple and forging a marriage and also taking care of a young child when you have, you know, work responsibilities.
What do they think of the film?
We've only heard their reactions through our co-filmmaker, Tsering Perlo, who's actually living in Tibet right now, and so he's in better contact with him than we are. But we did send back a rough cut of the film when we were finishing the editing of it a year ago, and Perlo showed it to them out in the pasture, and so we got an email back saying that they apparently loved it. And especially Yama, I guess, noted that she was really pleased and proud that people saw how hard she worked.
You shot the film in the summer of 2007, so it's 2010 now, so all is well with Yama and Locho. And
yes, we actually just got some photographs emailed to us of the family about a month ago, and we were just thrilled to see how healthy they look. Yama's had a second child since we last saw them, and she does suffer from a very challenging illness, so we were really glad to know that she was able to have this other child and still seems to be in you know, decent health, although she does have this chronic illness. It doesn't make things easy for her, but they do sound like they're doing really well, and apparently Locho has taken over a herd of yaks that had been for sale by another nomad who had decided to sell off his herd and move into town, which is one of the kind of themes in the film. And so apparently they've effectively doubled the size of their herd since we last saw them.
Yeah. Locho told you he started herding yaks when he was 6 years old. His mother had died, and his grandmother told him he would not be going to school. Yama at one time thought she would be a nun. Today, how do they feel about their way of life? They've added to the herd.
Yes, I think that in the film, when they do go into sort of their hopes and dreams for themselves and sort of, you know, looking back at their own lives, they do express the desire to have maybe explored other lifestyles. You know, as Yama does say, she at first had wanted to be a nun. But I think, you know, those things come up in the interview, but we felt very, it seemed very clear to us that they are very proud of their lifestyle. And as much as they might kind of talk about or dream about other things, they are very solidly committed to this way of life. And, you know, they're very good at it. So I think that their main interest in exploring other ways of living are really only to benefit their children when they see the environment around them changing and these other opportunities arising. And I think they realize that the life that they've had is going to be very different from the one that their children are going to be, you know, having to address. And so they do want to send their children to school, you know, just to be able to basically compete in, you know, these new sort of modern, the new modern context.
It's hard for me to imagine this couple living a life without animals.
Sorry, without animals?
Without animals.
Oh, yes. The animals are central. They're everything. The yaks are everything to them. You know, they serve as transportation when they move among the different pastures they live in throughout the year. You know, they sell the hair from the yaks to receive cash for some of the supplies they need to buy in town. They use the yak hair itself for all the ropes and the fabric they need for their tents and their, you know, different saddle things and bridle ropes and, you know, I mean, everything they use pretty much are things that they make from the yak, you know, the food they eat. So it really is completely central to their lives.
Mm. What is it like for them to go to town?
Well, the experience in town apparently is changed in the last few years. Locho is the one who goes into town, so the men are the ones responsible for going into town and bartering or selling and buying the few supplies that they do need to purchase from the shopkeepers. And it's a challenge. I think that the language is a bit difficult. I think that shopkeepers and Tibetan herders like Locho have found some kind of common way of communicating numbers and basics. But the shopkeepers that we noticed Locho confronting, it's definitely a tense situation, and there's a lot of push and pull. And, you know, even one yuan, which is, you know, a very small amount of money to us, means everything to someone like Locho, whose family typically functions on, you know, maybe a few hundred dollars a year in U.S. terms.
When you arrived in Tibet, did you have any idea of what you'd find? Did you have a narrative in mind?
We didn't have a narrative. We had been to the Kham region before on a previous trip. We had not been to Zatchika, the specific area where we shot the film, but we had been, you know, generally introduced to this area of the world, and we were interested in the nomadic culture that we had seen on that previous trip. So our only goal or expectation was that we wanted to make some kind of project that had to do with a typical nomad family. And, you know, what that would mean, we didn't really have any plans around. But my partners and I were really interested in, you know, personal stories and allowing those experiences then speak to any of the larger kind of issues that might be related. But we really wanted to keep it to a very personal level.
Yeah, you're really out of the picture. So has there been any interest from anyone in television around the world, here in the U.S., in Europe, in Asia?
Well, actually, the U.S. television rights to the film are held by PBS, who we have a co-production deal with. So they had helped us with some early funding, and in exchange, they actually own the film. And so we are waiting to hear what specific program in PBS might pick it up for programming in, say, the 2011 or 12 season. Outside of the States, we haven't heard anything yet, but we're really hopeful. We have someone, we have a distributor who's working on our behalf and traveling to international film festivals and markets. And, you know, it would actually be our dream if something like this was able to be screened on Chinese television, which obviously has a huge audience, you know, huge numbers in terms of audience, but more so I just think that this is a film about a very, you know, typical Tibetan family that I'm sure many people even in China aren't quite familiar with.
Well, I'm so happy it will be screened here in Champaign-Urbana. And I guess there we'll wrap it up. Lynn, thank you so much for talking with me this afternoon.
My pleasure.
And that was Lynn True, one of the filmmakers of Summer Pasture, which will be screened during the Asian Film Festival 2010, Visualizing Tibet. Summer Pasture will be screened Friday evening at 7 p.m. at the Spurlock Museum. This is Focus, and we're talking this morning about Tibet and the film festival and the films that will be shown. Our guests joining us this morning are Elliot Sperling. He's on the phone with us, and Nancy Jervis. She's in the studio with me. Nancy Jervis is the program director for the Asian Educational Media Service at the U of I. Elliot Sperling is at Indiana University, where he teaches in the Tibetan Studies program. And he will be a special festival guest, as will Lynn True. She will be here on Friday to talk about Summer Pasture. Listeners, you can join us this morning with a question, a comment, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Our email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Elliot Sperling, what can you tell us about this way of life and how rapidly it's disappearing? It sounds like it is disappearing.
Actually a very serious issue now, because in certain areas specifically, more specifically, actually in the Tibet Autonomous Region, the government has been trying to settle nomads. In other words, to put them into sedentary settlements where they might have some fields outside, but they're won't be nomadizing, as it were. And these have been fairly depressing by all reports. People who have been there tell me that these settlements are put out in, you know, rather far away, but they're constructed with substandard, or what we would consider substandard housing, very drab housing units. And they're very bleak. And to date, a lot of the nomads who have been settled there have been turned into wards of the state. In other words, they can't really support themselves in the what at least was minimally a self-sufficient way that they did as nomads, and now they've become dependent upon state subsidies, which is another broader issue with regard to economic development in Tibet, because a lot of what has happened in Tibet in terms of development has been due to central government subsidies. So rather than making Tibet flourishing, even though there is money that is going in there, it is very dependent upon the central government. And this seems to be repeating itself now in the current attempts to settle nomads in the Tibet Autonomous Region.
Why does the government want to settle them?
There are a number of reasons that one can think of, but certainly for one thing, it centralizes them. Number one. Number two, it is really the imposition by the central government of a very, very strict and narrow view of development upon these people. And, of course, the nomads, you know, traditionally in Tibet have been fairly independent, which, of course, is what happens when, you know, you're moving around over great distances with your herds. One does not become extremely wealthy, although there have been some cases, you know, within traditional Tibetan society in which people have become relatively well off like that, but one doesn't starve either. It's there is a general degree of self-sufficiency. Now, again, you know, this is not happening all over Tibet, but this resettlement is happening in enough areas that people are really starting to worry about it. And again, it's, you know, it's something that comes from the center, you know, rather than something that comes from the locality.
Hmm. Nancy Jervis?
Yeah, I just I wanted to add something to something that Elliot said earlier. I think if you think about the Chinese attitudes towards Tibetans, basically the attitude has been, and to some extent still is, very patronizing, and very much thinking of Tibet and Tibetan civilization as a lesser form of civilization, as opposed to Chinese civilization, which is agriculturally based. So when they think of developing Tibetans, they think of how can we make, you know, how can we get rid of this primitive nomadic culture? And what you see in the films, on the other hand, especially if you think about Summer Pasture, you see people who are or they are nomads. They are in what the Chinese would refer to as a primitive type of civilization. Yet you feel that they are very at home in their skins. You do not, and as Elliot points out in some of the other films, you feel the richness of the culture. You do not feel that at all. But I think from, you know, I've talked to many Chinese intellectuals in the cities and professionals, and their attitude is, you know, we're lifting them up. And you see this in some way. You see this in some of the other films, the propaganda film 1963, Serfs, which it really shows you the attitude at the time. But you see it also even in more recent film like Song of Tibet, which is not a propaganda film and is made by a very distinguished filmmaker. But there is still this lingering attitude that comes across.
Hmm. Yeah, I think I should also add this is Tibetan civilization is actually fairly unique and very interesting in this. It has a very strong nomadic component, but it is also agrarian. Back into the oldest records that we have of Tibetan civilization, it includes farming. So you have nomads and you have farmers together, and they're part of the same civilization. I mean, they speak the same language, although you know, there are a lot of usages, and some people even say there are nomadic dialects. But, you know, they basically see themselves as kin. You know, their Tibetan Buddhist identity, which is very strong, remains strong today, is very much there. But it's unique in this mixture of both nomadism and farming. And, of course, it is that element, the sedentary element, which has also given rise to a very highly literate civilization in Tibet. But, you know, it's not like Mongolia, where, you know, you have such an emphasis on nomadism and, you know, the creation of this nomadic Mongol empire. The Tibetans had both. They have nomads and they have farmers.
Hmm. Let's talk a little bit about one of the films that will be screened this week. And as Nancy Jervis mentioned, it is a piece from the 1960s. Serfs is the title. It's a propaganda film produced by China. What does the film reveal about China's view of Tibet and Tibetans at that time, and how informative is it of where we are today? I think you touched on that already, Nancy.
If I could
sure.
Speak. Yeah. This is the basic template of China's place in Tibet, that it is there to lift the Tibetans out of cruel feudal serfdom. Now, mind you, that's not all of it. I mean, part of it, of course, has to do with the Marxist idea that nationalities inevitably grow together, and that's why the Tibetans and Chinese are together. But part and parcel of that is the fact that the Tibetan place within China has been tremendously beneficial to Tibetans because it has lifted them out of this cruel, barbaric feudal serfdom. And that movie was made after the suppression of the 1959 uprising. It was actually a much broader uprising. It was not just in 1959, but it was the crushing of that rebellion that sent the Dalai Lama and many other Tibetans into exile in India. And so, of course, it was to be expected that China would then make propaganda about the barbaric, cruel, feudal serf system that existed under the Dalai Lama. Mind you, a Dalai Lama with whom they worked and whose political and economic systems they did not change throughout the 1950s in central Tibet. And so, of course, it presents it as I've you know, written and said before, in almost a cartoonish light. So you have things portrayed there, which, for instance, you know, there's a scene or two with the feudal master basically being carried, not even walking. He's being carried by one of his serfs, which, as a Tibetan friend of mine has pointed out, is extremely uncomfortable. Forget about the person doing the carrying. Just to be carried around on someone's back is actually not very comfortable, on their shoulders, rather. So this is one of the things which you show, but it's interesting that that is China's response even now to Tibetan discontent. And so in 2008, which was a year in which you had massive Tibetan protests that hadn't been seen really in quite some time, and it was all across the Tibetan plateau, in response to that, China began more propaganda about the liberation of Tibetans from the cruel feudal serf system that existed under the Dalai Lama. And so they proclaimed in March of 2009 a new holiday, Serfs Emancipation Day. And this was accompanied with all sorts of propaganda and even photographs, which ironically, most of the photographs are actually taken by British imperialists and the same people who use photographs of China to portray traditional China as being a cruel and barbarous Oriental realm. And so they use these things to portray themselves as the liberators, the sort of thing that you might have found in Western propaganda half a century or a century ago with regard to China.
Okay. Nancy Jervis, you want to add anything there?
Just, you know, I was in China right after those demonstrations, and I talked to people who work in the media, and it's very difficult to have a conversation about these things because basically we all have different information. And so, you know, our information is completely different from what people, even in the media, get over there. So there's a level to which you just have to stop. But it reminded me very much of what people used to say about African Americans in this country in the 1950s and 60s.
Hmm. We have to wrap it up here, but I do want to ask one last question. Lin Tru has a dream of having Summer Pasture screened in China on Chinese television. Could it happen?
I think it could, as long as there is nothing that is overtly political. There's a very funny thing, I have to say. You have a lot of leeway to discuss a lot of things in China, and people shouldn't get the wrong idea. I mean, it is a one-party state, and I don't want to downplay the authoritarianism, but there's a lot of lively intellectual discussion. But when you get to something like the Tibet issue, it's as if you're back 40 years ago. But there are things dealing with Tibet, as long as they are not overtly political, which do get a hearing. And again, there's a big audience for portrayals of traditional Tibetan lifestyles. So I think she might very well get an audience there.
Okay. Nancy, one quick word.
No, I agree, and I've seen some wonderful, I think the ethnographic quality of that film is really what might work and what might get it on television. And I just hope everybody, you know, pick your films, and I mean, you may not be able to stay there for all of them, but we hope you can come to as many as you can.
Visualizing Tibet is the theme of the 2010 Asian Film Festival at the Spurlock Museum at the University of Illinois and at the Art Theater in downtown Champaign. The festival opens tomorrow evening and runs through Sunday. It is free and open to the public. And my thanks this morning to Nancy Jervis and Elliot Sperling. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Coming up, another hour of Focus, but first we'll stop here for a market update and news.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Craft League of Champaign-Urbana, presenting their 28th annual Arts and Craft Show on November 13th and 14th at the Urbana Civic Center. Open Saturday 10 to 5 and Sunday 10 to 4. More information is available at 367-9546. Support for agricultural programs comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at agrigoldgiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. We're at mid-session. Prices have turned negative in the last hour. Let's look at particulars. In Kansas City, December wheat now trading 757.5, down 13.5. March 775.25, down 11.5. May 788, down 6.5. December wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade is at 707, down 10.25. March 749, down 8.5. December corn 580, down 2. March 593, down 2. May 5.